My name is Cease Corgan, I'm an alcoholic. Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. If you don't know where that is, go to Denver, hang a left, go 1,200 miles, and you walk right into me. My sobriety date is January the 16th, 1952. On behalf of all of the speakers, I would like to thank you for the fruit baskets that you put into their rooms. I had a difficult time getting here. I had canceled airplanes and everything. I got here at 12:30 midnight, hadn't eaten all day, was thinking there's going to be a nice fruit basket in my room. I get in there and there's 7 balloons and a camera. I tried to eat the camera and I couldn't, but I ate 3 balloons. It says here to talk slow. My God, that's going to be tough for me. I'm a motivational speaker and it's tough for me to talk slow. But it reminds me of a story of a preacher that wanted to raise some money, and he sent his congregation out to sell Bibles. One lady came in, she'd sold 4 Bibles, another one sold 6, another one 10. A guy came in and he'd sold 143 Bibles. The preacher called the whole congregation in, he said, "Tell us how you sold 143 Bibles." And he said, "Well, it was like this. I would walk up to the door and I would ring the doorbell. When they came to the door, I would say, 'I am selling Bibles. Would you like to buy one, or would you sooner that I read it to you?'" I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about the drinking, but I'm going to tell you I did drink. I'm not here by mistake. I drank fast, and I drank quick, and I drank a lot. I came from a small little town. I wanted to be an athlete. Never had a drink until I was 16 years of age. I was a good athlete. Didn't smoke, didn't drink. One day, I found out after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous why I started drinking. In the doctor's opinion, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal way. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. When I was 16 years of age, I became restless, irritable, and discontented. I'd never had a drink. I didn't like the discipline of my school, I didn't like the discipline of my home, and I didn't like the discipline of my church. And so I ran away from discipline. And to show you how swift I was, I ran into the army to get away from discipline. It really wasn't one of my smartest moves, I'll tell you. And I got dressed up in that big uniform, lied about my age, and that night we went downtown. I went downtown with the rest of the men, and we went into a beer parlor. And I had the first drink that I'd ever had in my life, to my knowledge. And great things started to happen to me. All of a sudden, I was a great conversationalist. Some guy said something to me that I didn't like, and I had muscles. And I almost had a fight. Then I went dancing. And oh my God, you should have seen me. I was Canada's own Fred Astaire. For the benefit of you young ones, he was a great dancer. Then I took a girl home. And in those days, Clark Gable, Charles Boyer, with the great lovers, I was all of them combined into one. But the next morning, I woke up and I was a scared little guy that had come in from the farm the day before to join the army. But every night I could be what I wanted to be because I would drink. I did well in the army. I became an instructor because I'd just come out of high school. But I got kicked out when I was 17. I went back home and I worked in an aircraft factory and did very well, but I got some responsibility that I didn't like, and I became once again restless, irritable, and discontented. And so I ran away once again. I ran back into the army. Told them I'd never been in before. This time I was a genius. I got recommended for my commission. I'd love to stand here and tell you I was an officer in the Canadian Army, but I got kicked out when I was 18. I went back home, and I got a job in an advertising department of a newspaper, and I did very well. But once again, I got too much responsibility, and I ran once again, and I ran into the Navy. I just didn't know when to quit. Everybody was trying to stay out of the service, and I was trying to get in. And I got recommended for my commission. I went away to officer's training, and I'd love to stand here and tell you I was an officer in the Canadian Navy. But I got kicked out of officer's training. It seems that an officer didn't appreciate me telling him what he could do with his ship. And yesterday, I was looking out there, and I saw one of those big ships. And really, it's a physical impossibility to do with that ship what I told him to do with it. But I didn't get kicked out of the Navy. I just got kicked out of officer's training. And by this time, I was rebellious. And I heard that in the merchant Navy that gunners could go from the regular Navy into the merchant Navy, and there weren't any officers. And I didn't like the discipline of the officers, and so I went into as a gunner in a merchant ship. Drank all over the world, sailed all over the world. And you people in the United States owe me a great deal of gratitude, but you have never, ever mentioned it to me. I sailed in the Atlantic. Finally, I got a ship that was going to New Zealand and Australia. We got down to Australia, and we had a cargo of liquor, a whole ship full of liquor for your servicemen that came down from the islands into Australia. And some of the liquor didn't get unloaded. And our ship was the only empty one, and one of your ships got torpedoed, and they pulled it back, and they salvaged it and pulled it back to Australia, and the government ordered us, it was loaded with tanks, not drunk tanks, but tanks, fighting tanks, and they ordered our ship to take your tanks up to New Guinea. And we went up there, and those Japanese people didn't like us coming there, and they were shooting at us and bombing us and trying to torpedo us. But we got your tanks delivered into New Guinea. And we went back, and we found that liquor that hadn't been unloaded. And we started having a party. And suddenly a bunch of planes came. But there were our own planes coming out to escort us back in. But we thought it was the Japanese planes coming back. So the captain ordered us to start the fire at. And you have to visualize. The captain is up here like where I'm standing this morning. I'm right down there and I'm in charge of a big forward gun. And we're really giving it. We're firing there, and all of a sudden the captain realized it's our own airplanes, and he got real panicky. I don't know why we weren't hitting them, and but he had to stop us from firing. So he's got a big megaphone that would go all over to all of the guns, and he screamed down and he said, "Cease fire." I kept the war going for another couple of days. He said if I'd have got one of our own planes, I'd have been a Japanese ace. But one day I know I'll get a medal from some of you people for doing that. I got married when I first went into the Navy, and I'd love to stand here and tell you that I was a good husband, a good father, but I wasn't, because I'd become alcoholic. I'm still married to that same lady. I know that's not popular today, but she didn't leave. She stayed there. It's not my fault that we're still married, I'll tell you. I come back from the Navy, and by the time I got back from the Navy, we had a little girl. She was 14 months in age, and her and I became real buddies and back from the war. And I started getting jobs, I started losing jobs. And I had learned how to gamble in the Navy and in the Army. I had learned how to cheat gamble. And that's part of my story, because that's how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. One night I was at a stag party. We were raising money for our hockey team. Incidentally, our hockey team scout here comes out here to play at Portland. And I was looking after the bar. I don't know why. They asked me to look after the bar. And they had all gambling tables and everything, and suddenly the bar wasn't too busy because everybody was gambling. And I decided to make it busy. And I started serving myself. Didn't pay for it. And suddenly I realized that I had enough for that flit into me to get into the poker game. And I got into the poker game and I got caught cheating. It's okay to cheat, I guess, because I cheated a lot of times in a poker game. But this guy that caught me was an ex-commando in the Canadian Army. He weighed 275 pounds. And he caught me cheating. And he and I had a fight. Or I should say, he had a fight. He hit me and I hit the cement floor, and I got up, and he hit me and I hit the cement floor, and we did that a whole bunch of times. And finally I stayed down because I couldn't get up. It makes sense, doesn't it? They took me to the hospital. I was in the hospital for 5 days and nobody came to see me, not even my family. None of my good drinking buddies. I guess they didn't know I was there. And the fifth day I was there, I was going to be discharged the next day. And my doctor, thank God for my little doctor, he had been in the service with him. And he said, "Cease, I have done everything I can do for you. I've built you up physically and the rest is up to you." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I was in the service with you. You should have had your commission, but you didn't get it because of your alcoholism. And I believe that you're an alcoholic." I was 27 years old. Back in 1952, there weren't too many people 27 years old going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he suggested that that's what I do. And he left me laying there in bed. Now I know why I became an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic because I'm a Protestant. Don't laugh, you Catholics. I lived in a Catholic community, and they treated me bad. They called the bingos in Latin, so I couldn't understand it. And I grew up hating Catholics. And here I am in a Catholic hospital. It was before Medicare in Canada. And I'd given a bad check for a private room. And that little nurse, because I was Protestant, she was mad. And she wasn't going to let me out of that hospital until I paid that bill. But that night, two fellows came to see me. Uninvited, they came. And they talked to me about themselves. They told me the story. They didn't talk to me about me the way everybody else did. And they looked good. Their face was shining. Their eyes were shining. It's important when you go on a 12-step call that you look good, because they impressed me. I don't know what they said, but I know they didn't condemn me. They just told me what had happened to them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me that they were going to have an emergency meeting the next morning for me. In those days, if you got a live one, you had emergency meetings. And so I had to get out of that hospital, and I had to find some money, and I didn't dare phone my wife. So I phoned the only person that my credit was any good with, and that was my bootlegger. And he was a taxi driver, and I phoned him, and he came up and bailed me out of the hospital and took me to my first meeting in a little restaurant. 15 people were there. That was how many people were in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time in our city. And they all came. In those days, you got a live one and they all came, believe me. I knew every one of them. I had drank with every one of them. Once again, they talked about themselves. They didn't talk about me, except that they said they could help me. And then they said they would drive me home. And I said, no, 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 no. I can get home okay. Because, you see, I had been away a few other times for 4 or 5 days. And that little gal of Amrad, who is a colored babe, she didn't appreciate that. And sometimes some guys would take me home and she'd run them off. And I'd found these really good friends and I didn't want them to get run off. But fortunately, some of the ladies, it was before Al-Anon in our town, but some of the ladies that were married to these 15 people had been up to see Babe and told her what I was going to try to do. And I walked in the door with my two friends, and she hugged me and kissed me, and she said, I think everything is going to be okay, hon. Holy malarkey. If nothing else, I stayed in AA that day because she'd changed already. Boy, what a deal. That night we went to our first AA gathering. It was a Saturday night. And they had a social first, and they played games. And I can remember there were a bunch of old people, holy malarkey, 45, 50 years old. And I can remember they played pin the tail on the donkey. That really wasn't my idea of a Saturday night, I'll tell you. Then I looked, and Babe is having a great time. She's just loving all this. After the social, they had a meeting. After the meeting, a couple of the old-timers, they were sober about 18 months. They took me into another room, and they said, cease. In those days, they used to say there's no muss in AA. And they said, you heard tonight that there's no muss in AA, but tomorrow morning there's a breakfast meeting here at 8 o'clock and you must be here. And I said I'd be there. A little fellow by the name of Bobby Motherwell put his arm around me and he said, Cease, we love you and we need you and we want you. I didn't think anybody needed me. I didn't think anybody wanted me. And my wife had informed me nobody loved me. And then he said, you got to get a big book. And I said, I haven't got any money. And he said, you can buy it on the installment plan. 50 cents a week. Can you afford that? I said, yeah, I can afford that. There were $4 then. Then he said, you got to get a sponsor. And I saw old Elmer sitting there, and I drank with Elmer, and boy, he's looking good. And I thought he'd been sober forever. I hadn't seen him for quite a while. So I went over and asked Elmer to be my sponsor. He was only sober 10 days. He didn't even know what a sponsor was. And he said yes. You know what? He's still my sponsor. We have the longest relationship of sponsee in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't imagine that we're going to be written up and believe it or not or anything. I just thought I'd mention. Elmer came to Chicago with me, but in January. The guys in Chicago didn't believe that there was an Elmer, because I kept talking about Elmer and they'd never seen Elmer. And so at the international conference, I pointed Elmer out when we had the countdown. I said, "That's Elmer, and the guy standing there is the second guy that's ever sponsored." And so he come back, and the guy that was with me said, "I saw Elmer." And they said, "Did you talk to him?" These guys from Chicago said, they said, "No, we just saw him. Cease pointed out to him." And they said, Cease would just point some old guy out and say, "That's Elmer," you know. So when I was invited to Chicago, I said, "Can I bring Elmer?" And they said, "You bring Elmer and we'll pay his expenses." And he came with me to Chicago in January, and he had a great time. And he's a great fellow. And he and I, we're kind of crazy AAs. We still go to 2 meetings a week. You know, a lot of people, I don't know what happens, they don't do that. But Bobby told me at this group, they have 2 meetings a week, and I want you to make a commitment that you'll go to 2 meetings a week. And I did that, and I'm still doing it. And I'm grateful for that. In 1963, Tommy I, that's going to be here, we got invited to a young people's conference. They wanted somebody that was sober 10 years and somebody that was sober 5 years, and they invited Tommy and I to Detroit. And we went there. My God, we were old-timers. And I haven't stopped since then. I've been speaking at conferences. You people have had me in every state in the United States. I told my wife, I became Citizen of the Year in 1984. And I said, "When those ladies came to see you when I was in the hospital, did they mention that I may become Citizen of the Year?" And she said, "No. I didn't give it much thought either." Because I really wasn't a Citizen of the Year, believe me, in those days. But I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to deals like this, not nearly as big as this deal, but I went to everywhere they asked me to go, and I became an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into service, and it was just so wonderful. And I stayed sober the first 3 years in AA just by pats on the back. Everybody would say, "You're doing a good job, kid." And I loved that. And then one day a horrible thing happened. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me and talked to the older members. The older members walked right by me and talked to the younger members. All of a sudden I became a middle member. And I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, Al-Aton, Alcoholics Anonymous, or Al-Anything. One day you're going to become a middle member. And it's a bad thing. Just like a hole in a donut. You're nothing. Just stand out there and people walk by you. And I thought maybe I should go out and practice a little bit and come back and get the treatment again. Thank God I didn't have to do that. We had a guy in the group by the name of Ernie, and we have discussion groups where I come from. And we asked Ernie if he would chair the next month, next 3 months. And Ernie said he would, providing we did one thing. We said, "What's that?" And he said, "I want us to do the steps as a group. We'll start at step one, and we will do them. Not study them, we will do them." And we thought we'd humor old Ernie, so we went along with it. Sent us home, told us to take our big books and read the first 58 pages. And that sounds like an easy thing to do, but when you think you're going to get an exam on them, well, it's not easy. I'd phone Elmer and say, what do you think Ernie's going to ask us? And he said, I don't know. Elmer'd come over to my house and we would ask each other questions on the first 58 pages. We went on back to the first meeting when we were supposed to take step one, and Ernie didn't even ask us if we anything about it. Just said, did you read it? And we all put up our hands. We'd all read it. What a deal. And then he said, okay, we're going to take step one. Well, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I didn't even know there was a second part to that step. I just knew I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't realize that I had an unmanageable life. I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. Now, I know you won't even know what I'm talking about in the United States, because none of you people have had that. But sometimes some Canadian may come down here and you'll say, we heard another Canadian talking about that. And so I owed $6,200 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it. I came here by way of a poker game, and I owed it to some strange people that would phone in the middle of the night and threaten me if I didn't pay it. I got a good job. I got a real good job. I was in the fur coat business. I got a job managing a fur department for a big store. I was making good money. Finally, my boss got sick and tired of getting phone calls about this money and me getting phone calls because it was wasting a lot of time. And he took me to the bank. And he endorsed my note for $6,200. And he and the bank manager wrote the checks, had me sign them, and they sent the checks out. I don't know why they did it that way. But 3 years later, he bailed me out for $7,200, $7,500. You see, I had a problem with money. But I realized that money problems have nothing to do with money. It's got a lot to do with big shot ism. I was the kind of a guy, you know, I'll pay the bill. We'd walk into my good wife, Babe, and I would walk in to buy some furniture. Guy would say, here's something for $300. I'd say, you got something for about $750. You know, big shot ism. I know none of you even know what I'm talking about, but maybe one day you'll find somebody and you'll explain, I heard a Canadian speaker talk about that. And he bailed me out again. But he made me make some promises that I would stop doing what I was doing. And thank God he did. But I found out that, you know, that I had other defects of character right there, but in the unmanageability of my life, that was one. To show you I've changed a little bit, many, many years ago, I owed a guy in Montreal. I was in the fur business. And I owed a guy $10,000, and he was writing me, phoning me, and saying some bad things to me. And so I wrote him a letter. And I said, I like these furs. I'd like to have fall dating on them. This is the middle of July, and I wasn't selling many. And so I told him that I was going to pay him in the fall, but I'd send him some money now. And I sent him a certified check for $100. But I wrote him a letter and I threw a little philosophy at him. I said, if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it would take a long time. But if I took it a telephone pole at a time, it would take longer, but I'd finally get there. Sign it yours truly, Cecil E. Corgler, manager of Cecil Corgler Furs and Fashions. Send it away. 4 days later, I get a letter back. That's when the post office was operating properly. And he congratulated me on my letter-writing ability, and he told me that maybe I should get out of the fur business and go writing letters for somebody. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel, Mamsel and Amsel, Montreal. P.S. Would you mind sending me another telephone pole? I sent him a lot of telephone poles, and when I was finished the fur business, which was 1966, I sold out. My credit was good for any amount with Mo Amsel because of the telephone poles. So if any of you are having financial troubles, if ever you do, send telephone poles. It helps. We went on to step two where it says, can't believe that a power greater than ourselves could throw us a sanity. In those days, there weren't any treatment centers. They sent you to mental hospitals. So I'd never been in a mental hospital. So I said to the guys, how can I come back from somewhere I haven't been? And they said, Cease, you have a negative attitude. And I had a negative attitude. I was one of those guys that could sit around trying to help somebody that wasn't there. Have you ever done that? And we would say things like, I heard, they say, everybody says, have you heard? Did you know? Isn't it awful? People say, did you ever? Somebody said, would you think? Don't say I told you. Oh, it's awful. And I was that kind of a guy. I could sit around helping people that weren't there. I know not a few people do it, but I call it the dirty dozen. And so they told me that I had a negative attitude. And I didn't believe that I had a negative. Where are you going? You're my best friend. Gee. Best friends walk right out. Her and I have known each. We were in Akron, Ohio in 1969 together. And there she just leaves and walks away. So they told me I had a negative attitude. I was something like a negative barber. Guy fit into the barber chair one day. He said, like a haircut last week for 3 weeks. The barber said, why 3 weeks? Well, he said, I'm going on vacation. The barber said, where are you going? And the guy said, I'm going to London, England. The barber said, you're not going to London, England. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. He said, I wouldn't go there if I, you know. I've never been there, but I heard. It's a lousy place to go. Too many people, too many cars. The guy said, look, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going to Paris. The barber says, you're not going to Paris. He says, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, no, I've never been there, but I heard. They really please the tourists. He said, look, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going to Rome. The barber says, you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. Wouldn't go there. He said, a lot of Catholics there. Guy said, I don't care. I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but he said, I heard different kind of a Catholic over there. 3 weeks later, the guy come back, slid into the barber chair, and the barber said, how was your trip? He said, it was good. He said, it wasn't. He said, it was. He said, it wasn't. He said, you didn't go to London. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He said, I did. And he said, I'd love to stay there long. When I get on Paris, he says, you didn't go to Paris. He said, I did. He says, you didn't. He said, I did. And he said, I'd love to stay there long. I don't want to get on to Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. He said, I did. He says, you didn't. He said, I did. And he says, you'll never believe what happens. He said, I got an audience with the Pope. And he says, you didn't. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He said, you'll never believe what happened. He said, I knelt down to kiss the Pope's ring, and you'll never believe what the Pope said. And the barber said, what? And he said, where the heck did you get that lousy haircut? Boy, this is difficult today to be up here to be the last speaker after all those speakers you've heard. Holy malarkey. I feel like Elizabeth Taylor's next husband's going to feel like. I know what's expected of me. I don't know how to make it interesting anymore. But I found out about a negative attitude, and I decided I didn't want that anymore. We went on to the third step, and they said, whether we have to make the decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as I understood them. Now, I know you people all are good at making decisions, but I wasn't. I mean, I just didn't like making decisions. But they made me promise, or, and he said, look, at Cease, you didn't believe in God, but you found... You had an unmanageable life. You found a manager in step two. Now tonight, go home and ask the manager to help you make a decision. And so I did that. I went downstairs. I didn't want Babe to see me doing such a foolish thing. And I said, God, I had a bad job of managing my life. And I want you to help me. And that's how simple I had to keep it. I had to keep it simple because I don't like complicating things. I used to, but in Alcoholics Anonymous I didn't. I have a friend of mine back home that has a ranch. Another friend said, how did you get the name of your ranch? And he said, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q, my wife wanted to call it Susie Q, my son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q, and my daughter wanted to call it Susie Bar Q, so we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. And the guy said, that's a great name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding. So you see, you know, keep it simple or you may not survive the branding. So I just kept it simple. The next week we went to the meeting and Ernie came along and gave us all a pencil and a paper. And we said, what's with this? And he said, well, I heard we're going to take the fourth step tonight. And he said, I heard that people couldn't find pencils and paper, so this is what it's about. And so we went home with our pencil and paper, and we did the fourth step just exactly as it tells us in this big book that I bought in the United States. And on page 65, it told me exactly how to do it, and I did it. And I wrote it down, I'm resentful at, and the cause and the effects, and we wrote it down. Now, we didn't have a big book study. We had a big book do it. That was the name of the group. Our group is called Do the Steps Group, not Study the Steps. So we all did it, came back. Golly, I was so proud of mine, I wanted to show it to Ernie. Ernie said, no, that is personal. And so I was really happy that I had done it. And I back home, we take fifth steps with men of the cloth. Now I know that I hear a lot of you people tell me you took your fifth step with your sponsor. I wouldn't take a fifth step with old Elmer. First of all, he's totally unscarred by education and doesn't know anything other than he's my sponsor. And he's a blabbermouth. I wouldn't dare tell him some of those things. And this book that I bought in the United States tells me on page 74, it says that rightly and naturally we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession, probably the Catholics, must and of course will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though we may have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. Elmer is not ordained. So I went to a Protestant minister. And this little minister, I took my fourth step with him. And not only that, we, in Prince Albert, we have 12 step or fifth step meetings with the men of the cloth. And we show them how to do them. And when we go through the steps, we send them to ministers or preachers or priests or whatever, even rabbis. So that's when I did that. I did my fifth step with Reverend Kasler, fine little guy. And he'd been sort of orangutan too, and he shared some things with me. He sort of took a fifth step with me, and he'd never had a drink. But he and I became real good friends, Presbyterian minister. And then we went on to step six, and you know what Ernie told us? He says, okay, you admitted you're powerless over alcohol, your life is unmanageable, you can't believe the power granted yourself could restore your sanity. You made a decision to turn your will and your life over the care of God as you understood him. Then he said you made a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself. And then he said you can't, you know, you went and talked to somebody else about it. And he said, but he told us before that it says in step five, that if we admitted to God, to ourselves, and then to another human being, And I went home and I did that. And I got down in the bathroom and I got down by the bathtub and I admitted it to God. Then I stood up and went to the mirror, and you know what? I changed stories from there to there. I'm capable of doing that. And then I had to do that a few times to get the two stories jiving. And then I went to another human being. I listened to you last night, and now you leave. Hey. Just can't trust your friends. Anyway, I took my fifth step. And then Ernie told us we really hadn't done it. He said, now are we entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character? You see, everybody puts so much emphasis on step 5, 4, and 5 that they forget about what's going to happen down the line. And we had to become entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then in step 7, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Isn't that great? But people think that there's no big deal. This is when we start getting well. And you know what I find in Alcoholics Anonymous, even in Al-Anon? Some of us are afraid of getting too good too fast. Don't worry about that. For 49 years I've been in this business, and I have never met a saint yet in our fellowship. So don't worry about that. Just do it. Become willing. You know, they told me that when it first came, they give that old word, how, you know, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I believe that we're pretty well all honest. But I heard a story, you know, that sometimes if it's to our advantage, we can be a little bit dishonest, especially with money. And I heard a story about a fellow that had a very successful business, and he had a mute bookkeeper. And you know what successful businessmen are like? He got thinking after a while, I wonder, is this guy honest? And he went back for 6 months and he checked the books and he checked them and rechecked them, and he found out he's $50,000 short. And he thought, well, how am I going to talk to this guy? He's mute. But he had a friend of his that did sign language. So he called him over and he told him his problem, and he said, I'm going to call the guy in the office and I'll tell you what to say and you say it and we'll find out what's wrong. So the guy came in and he said, I want to know where my $50,000 is. And the guy says, he wants to know where his $50,000 is. And the guy says, I don't know. And he said, what do you say? He says, he doesn't know. And he said, ask him again. And he said, he wants to know where his $50,000 is. I hope I'm not swearing. But and he said, I don't know. So he said, what do you say? He said, he doesn't know. The guy took a gun out and he put it on the table and he said, you tell him I'm going to shoot him if he doesn't tell me where my $50,000 is. He says, he's going to shoot you if you don't tell him where his $50,000 is. The guy says, I don't know. So he said, what did he say? He says, doesn't know. So the guy put the gun right up to his temple and he says, you tell him he's got 30 seconds and if he doesn't tell me, he's history. He said, he's going to shoot you in 30 seconds if you don't know tell him where it is. He says, it's in a tin can underneath the oak tree in my backyard. The guy said, what did he say? He said, he doesn't know. So you see, sometimes we can become dishonest. If there's $50,000 or $25, whatever it might be. But, you know, in talking about becoming too good too fast, I heard a story about little Johnny, and his mother caught him playing with himself. Not those that we see today, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But she said to little Johnny, she said, Johnny, if you keep doing that, you're going to go blind. And little Johnny says, well, can I keep it up when I need glasses? You see? we're all afraid of becoming too good too fast. And one time I told that story back in Canada, and when I was finished speaking, this dear old lady came back. It was right from the back of the room, and she's coming right at me. She looked like she was president of the Temperance Society. And I thought, oh my God, maybe I shouldn't have told that story. She came up, she shook my hand, she said, young man, this was quite a few years ago. She said, young man, I really enjoyed the way you led us through the steps. I particularly enjoyed that story about little Johnny. But she said, as I looked around, did you notice how many alcoholics were wearing glasses? And they went on to step 8. The next week we went on to step 8, where we had to make a list of all the people we'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And one year sober and you're leaving. Oh my God. Deeply hurt. Anyway, step 8, I said to Ernie, well, I did that in step 4. I made a list. And he said, knowing you, Corbel, you hurt somebody between step 4 and step 8. And I had. He said, just make the list. And so I made the list of the people I'd harmed, and it was quite an extensive list. Next one, we went back, Ernie said, have you all made your list? All of us put our hands up. And he said, okay, now we have to make the recommends to such people wherever possible. Except when to do so would injure them or others. That was probably the greatest step that I've ever done. I used to have a difficult time walking down my main drag in my city because I would meet guys that I'd assassinated their character, I'd owed them money, I had lied to them, and I made all of those amends. Some accepted them, some didn't, but I made them. It used to be about 8 miles down Central Avenue, but now I can walk down there, it's only about a half mile. And I can smile at people and say good morning because I made amends. I have a little guy that I sponsored, Jimmy, and Jimmy he did the best step 9. He phoned and made appointments, and he did it in 1 week, and except one person, he didn't make amends to his father. And he just couldn't get talking to his father at the right time. And one night he went to see his father, and he was going to make amends to him. And his dad said, Jimmy, let's go out to the farm tomorrow, and we'll spend tomorrow together. So Jim thought, well, I'll do it tomorrow. Jim went to the show. He was in the show about 15 minutes, and they called him out. His father died of a heart attack. And Jimmy hadn't done his amends to his dad. And he felt bad, and I'm his sponsor, and he came to me and talked to me about it, and I didn't know what to do. So we have a fellow by the name of Pastor Brian who does a lot of fifth steps. Pastor Brian, I phoned him, I said, let's take Jim for lunch because he's having a bad time. So Pastor Brian wrote out some stuff for him, and he said, we're going up to the graveyard. Told Jimmy to kneel down and told Jimmy to read this stuff that he'd written out for him. He made his amends. So don't wait to make those amends, because Jim said that was the toughest amend that he had to make, was to somebody that he should have made it before. Don't waste your time on that. And then step 10, greatest step in the world, where we continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. When I was sober 10 years, I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. I had a big job. I had a company car. I had a company expense account. And I was big. I'll tell you, I was big. I was going to meetings every week. I was doing a step series at the penitentiary. We have a lot of jails in our town. I'd drive up in my big Lincoln and I'd think, boy, these guys are lucky that the great one comes up here every week. You know, I'd come back to my own meeting and I'd walk in all duded up, looking good. And I was working for the wealthiest man in the city of Prince Albert. And we were running the largest ladies' wear store in the whole province of Saskatchewan, and I was looking after the furs for 5 stores. And I was big. I was doing television shows with fashions and doing a deal without even written script, just right off the top of the head, and models come out and talking about them. And I was great, and everybody knew me through the television show. But one day, it seemed that the store got too small for the two of us, for my boss and myself. And it seemed that he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great one. And I went out of that store and I thought, they won't last long now. The great one's gone. They're still okay. They're still millionaires. Everything's all right. But my little cousin from Vancouver, she came to visit me. And I know our speaker talked about it last night, about, you know, things happening at the right time. She came to visit me, and I know God sent her to visit. And I was going off to a deal like this, and I was going with a deal with a dear old fellow by the name of Dave Murray, now up above. And Dave and I went down to see my cousin Fern, and I'm all dressed up in new threads, you know, with my money I got from being discharged from this beautiful job. And I stood up in front of Fern in my big egotistical way, and I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And she said these few simple words. She said, "You look really good on the outside, Cease. How are you really on the inside?" I drove off to this roundup. It was about 200 miles. And old Dave didn't talk to me because he'd heard what Fern had said to me. I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I spent 2 days in a hotel room with this big book, talking to God. I went back home and went in business for myself. That's no big deal. I had to do something, so that's what I did. And, you know, this can happen to you. It can happen to you even if you're alcoholic, if you aren't taking step 10 each day on a daily basis, where we continue to take a personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. It's continued to me today means continue. No other way to look at it. It's a very simple thing. And today I never go to bed unless I take a 10th step. My grandmother taught me a little prayer when I was just a real little guy. And I try to use it every night. And that little prayer is, "Please God, treat me tomorrow like I've treated everybody today." Careful when you say that one. But I take it on a daily basis because of what happened to me. Step 11, where it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, there's 17 more words in that step than any other step. So I figured, I'm not too swift, but I figured that's maybe the 17 words more important. And I do daily readings. Every day, I do daily readings. And I'll tell you, they're very important. I take this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read stuff that I'm supposed to read. And if any of you want to know what it is, it's all on tape. Out there, there's a tape made of this. I read page 86, 87, and 88. I read the prayer on page 63, third step prayer. The prayer on page 76, seventh step prayer. Pages 83 and 84, the promises. Page 132, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Page 164, the last two paragraphs, where it says we trudge to a happy destiny doesn't say we gallop, we trudge. I read 449 to 452 on acceptance by Dr. Paul. And I read St. Francis' Prayer on page 99 or page, another page if you have a different one. I do that every morning. I was speaking in Chicago. I did a retreat over there for them. And I told them that, and they phoned me and they said, we want that on tape. And I said, well, you know, it's okay if you put it on tape. No, we want your voice. And so a week later they phoned me and they said, how's the tape coming? And I hadn't done it. Three days later the guy said, look, it ceased. They told me that I was supposed to get that tape from you with all of that reading on it. So I went to a radio station where I have some good friends, and they put me in a room there, and I did all of that reading. And it's on tape. It's become quite famous, as a matter of fact, because people buy it to keep in their cars and to read it while they're listen to it while they're getting ready for work and stuff like that. And the tapers have it here. Practically all the tapers now have it in the country, because a lot of people don't take time to do that. And I take time because you never know who's out there to get you. There's always somebody that's going to aggravate your disease before the day is out. Sometimes before you get out of the house. I call Babe, Mrs. I want money. And I'll just be sneaking out the door and patter, pat, pat. I'm going to have my hair done, and when have you got any money? She's got money, but she wants my money. You know? I kiss her goodbye, tell her I love her, don't give her any money, and I'm gone. Sometimes she's still standing there when I get back at night. So you see, it's important that we do that step. You know what happened? I told you about not liking Catholics, and I... Two daughters married Catholics, Italian ones. They're the worst kind. Not only they have kids. They call the first one Anna Luisa. The next one Cella Maria. The last one Giovanni Anthony. Why could they do that to kids? You know? That's not all. I'd have to drive them to school, and the sisters would say, good morning, Mr. Corrigan, you know, and I'd have to smile. My grandchildren going to Catholic schools. But that's all right. I do that every morning, and believe me, I have good days. Did it this morning. Then on the next step we went. Next week, Ernie asked if we'd done it. We did it. We were all doing the reading. And then he said, okay, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening, people say, how do you have a spiritual awakening? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, what steps are they taking? They're talking about 1 to 11. I don't know, I figured that out. And I'm not the swiftest one, but I became kind of spiritual. And I know how to love people. I know how to accept love. I know how to do a lot of things for other people. I'm privileged to sponsor and listen to people. And I wrote another book, and it says, Openness for the Answer to All Your Problems. And inside it says, You Did Not Listen. And you know, a lot of people we sponsor don't listen. So please listen when your sponsor's talking to you or when anybody's talking to you about the program. And you know, it says we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic and still suffers. I guarantee that this morning that there's somebody in this room that has a football in their stomach. We don't have to go out there looking for them. We're right here. There'll be somebody suffering. And you can see it on their face. Go up and put your arm around them and tell them that you love them and that you want them and you need them. Our speaker talked about it last night, about Bill Wilson phoning Dr. Bob. We all say that we're miracles. We are not miracles. The miracle happened that night that Bill Wilson stood in the Mayflower Town, Akron, Ohio. A business deal had gone bad. He heard the tinkling of the glasses. He was going to go and have a Coke. Instead of that, he went and got some nickels. And he started phoning preachers. He got a hold of Henrietta Sarbeling. She said she knew somebody that needed help. And she phoned. And Dr. Bob was underneath the table with a potted plant. And Ann said, "I don't think that you could talk to him tonight." But Bill talked to him the next day. Bob didn't phone Bill. Bill phoned Bob. Henrietta Sarbeling phoned, and they got together. That was the miracle. We are the results of that miracle. And I'll tell you, you people have a great thing going. Don't anybody get in the road of this thing. Keep doing as the older members stop doing it. Someone else step in. And don't change it. Don't fix something that's good. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I want to thank the audience because you're a terrific audience. You listen. Last but not least, I want to thank God for giving me one more beautiful day to do something for the thing that saved my life, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.